Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Doesn't this feel like camping? How many went camping as kids? Quite a few. Not everybody. Quite a few. I don't know about your moms, but mine, you know, it was always pretty tense getting packed up. But once she was on the road, once we were actually out camping, she was really happy. So I have fond memories. And to this day, she doesn't remember much, but she remembers that. She said, those were the best, those camping trips. You know, makes me feel like, you know, what was it like, you know, what was it like when we all lived in tents and yurts and fragile little houses of various sorts, where first thing in the morning, first thing we did is just go out, you know, because there's no indoor plumbing. In my early 20s, I lived on a farm in New Brunswick. I was an organic farmer and we didn't have an indoor toilet, so the first thing you did was go outside every morning. And there was something just so alive about that. And because I could see, and I looked down from the outhouse at a tidal salt marsh creek. And the Bay of Fundy has really high tides, right? So this creek would be either really full and flooded on the highest tides or way down and see the mud bank. So I immediately knew what phase of the moon it was and how the tides were that day. And in the spring, before bed, you had to go down to the barn and see if there were any little lambs or goats being born. And look up at the stars, and it was absolutely still, and there was no light pollution out there. You could hear that hissy kind of faint, whatever it is, the sound the stars make. I don't know what that is, or is it my blood? I think I read it somewhere, what that hissy little hiss is. But you could hear that, there was nothing. Or you could hear the waves, or you could, yeah. So we forget what that's like, to live so close to the outdoors. Indoors, outdoors, it's not so different, but we forget. So I hope you're remembering. I hope you're remembering what it's like to live in this bigger world of not human-made things, you know. Clearing the mind and sliding in to that created space. A web of water streaming over rocks, air misty but not raining. Seeing this land from a boat on a lake or a broad, slow river coasting by. That's the beginning of mountains and rivers without end, which is a book-long sequence of poems by the great American Zen poet Gary Snyder. Some of you may be quite familiar with him, some may not. In my talks 4 years ago at our first session here, where we looked at Dogen's Mountains and Water Sutras, I used passages from Gary Snyder's essay and commentary on Dogen's Mountains and Waters Sutra in this book from 1990, Practice of the Wild. This is going to be a classic. This is going to endure, I think. And he has an essay in here called Blue Mountains Constantly Walking about Dogen's piece. The second year we came here, we focused on a different Dogen text, also about mountains and valleys. And then last year, we for those of you who were here, you may remember, we looked at the Taoist roots of Zen and the poetry of the old Taoist mountain hermits. So this year, we thought we'd revisit the Mountains and Water Sutra, and we were kind of prompted to do that by a new commentary on Dogen's Mountains and Water Sutra by our first Zen teacher, our first Soto Zen teacher, Shohaku Okamura, of whom we're very fond. We practiced with him in Kyoto, and now he's in Bloomington, Indiana. So we wanted a chance to read his commentary. But then, in the middle of doing that, I started reading a book called A Sense of the Whole, reading Gary Snyder's Mountains and Rivers Without End, which was which consists of the papers and talks that were given at a day-long symposium on Gary Snyder and his poem. And then I realized I wanna revisit this too. So Gary Snyder's, it seems somehow fitting to revisit Gary Snyder and his response to Dogen, and to see to see this as almost a contemporary Mountains and Water Sutra. To look at the ways it resonates with Dogen's text and the ways it goes beyond into areas of aesthetics and ethics and practice Dogen could not have imagined, because he couldn't have imagined what our world is like now. In his wildest dreams, I don't think. We want to create a kind of dialogue, right, between a call and response, if you will, between Dogen and Gary Snyder across the centuries and the ocean between in Japan and the West, particularly the American West, the North American West, which is the landscape Gary Snyder is so rooted in. So after I decided or proposed this approach, then I remembered that there's actually a precursor to this sesshin. I looked in the old paper, I happened for some other reason to be looking in our old paper newsletters. When Mountain Rain first began, we had paper newsletters. And that was 2002, that Mountain Rain was founded after 15 years as part of the Zen part of Karuna Meditation Society. And I realized in October of that year, we had a day-long retreat without a teacher at Lighthouse Park in West Vancouver. And we sat in an old, musty Boy Scout camp building. And we included, just like this, periods of outdoor walking. How many have been to Lighthouse Park? You've seen those big, big cedars and Douglas firs. You know, they're 500 years old, something or more. We didn't ordain until the year following, so we weren't doing Dharma talks. So what we did was select passages from Dogen's Mountains and Waters Sutra and Gary Snyder's commentary on it in here, and read these complementary passages alternately. We gave in two different voices, other people's voices, read them. And then we went and walked outdoors amongst the ferns and the cedars and the slugs and the Douglas firs. So let's continue that dialogue between two great sages, ancient and contemporary, and then extend it with our own mountains and waters practice, as we are doing. Gary Snyder begins Mountains and Waters Without End with two epigraphs. The first one's just one line. The notion of emptiness engenders compassion. It's a quote from the great Tibetan yogi and poet Milarepa. As I think you know, in Buddhist thought, wisdom is considered to be deep insight into the emptiness or boundlessness of all phenomena. The nature of all existence as impermanent and interdependently co-arising. Empty of any fixed self-existence. And from that insight of no separate self arises compassion for all beings, because it's not us against them anymore. And without those two wings of wisdom and compassion, our bodhisattva lives can't take flight. And as we'll see, the opening into wisdom and compassion is really the arc of this long poem sequence, which spans 40 years of Snyder's life and work and maturing practice. Now, the second epigraph is from Dogen, but it's not from Mountains and Water Sutra. It's one of my other all-time favorites, which is Painting of a Rice Cake. It's not one we've talked about a lot, so some of you might not know it. The epigraph goes like this. An ancient Buddha said, a painted rice cake does not satisfy hunger. Dogen comments, there are few who have even seen this painting of a rice cake, and none of them has thoroughly understood it. The paints for painting rice cakes are the same as those used for painting mountains and rivers. If you say the painting is not real, then the material phenomenal world is not real. The Dharma is not real. Unsurpassed enlightenment is a painting. The entire phenomenal universe and the empty sky are nothing but a painting. Since this is so, there is no remedy for satisfying hunger other than a painted rice cake. Without painted hunger, you never become a true person. I love this. So, the initial statement, a painted rice cake does not satisfy hunger, is the kind of conventional Zen put down of words, images, you know, sutras, as opposed to direct experience. But Dogen loves turning convention upside down. So he's saying paintings are just as much a phenomenon as the mountain itself. And in those days, of course, the very pigments that were used to paint came from the earth. Right, they used lapis lazuli stones to make those gorgeous colors. They used ochre. They used charcoal. Right, it was all from the earth and water. So he's saying, mountains, rivers, painted mountains and rivers are all phenomena arising and passing and flowing through our senses and our perceptions, in what Dogen calls all-inclusive continuous practice. So a mountain might wake us up, a painting of a mountain might wake us up, right? I'm sure you've had experiences of both, right? Painting of a flower, the flower itself, the poem. So I think this choice of the Dogen reference is beautifully apt, because Snyder's inspiration for his long poem was actually not Dogen's work, which he hadn't yet encountered. He didn't know Dogen's work when he started, when he came up with this idea. The idea came from a painting, came from a scroll painting. When Snyder was in graduate school, he was studying Oriental languages, he took sumi, or brush painting, ink and brush painting lessons, and he was just looking through books on Asian art, and he found a reference to a Chinese scroll painting called Mountains and Rivers Without End. And he just liked the title. And he remembered it. And through his university years, he pursued his interest in Buddhism and art and language, and in parallel, continuing his early devotion to mountaineering. He was a very serious mountain climber when he was in his teens. And then he went and worked two seasons as a fire lookout very near Mount Baker when he was in university. During that time, he attended talks by a Japanese artist who invited him to his apartment and served him his first Japanese matcha tea ceremony tea. It was the first time Gary Snyder was blown away. And they talked about the great Japanese monk painter, Zen painter, Sesshu. And that's when Snyder first conceived the idea of doing this long poem sequence called Mountains and Rivers Without End. So that was, I think, around, 1956. Mm. Where were you then? Some were around and some weren't. Right? And a month later, he went off to Japan to practice Zen. He spent most of the 1960s in Japan, a little bit on and off, practicing Rinzai Zen in Kyoto, and later living in a kind of hippie commune on a little volcanic island called Suwanose. And he began to publish his first poetry, first three books. And he also started assembling poems that he knew would become part of this long sequence. So some of the earliest ones came from the 60s. In 1969, he returned to Turtle Island, North America. He traveled around the country giving talks and readings. And I was fortunate enough to attend one of those in probably very early 1970, near Harvard. I was in Boston. And it was life-changing. It was pivotal for me to realize that poetry could sing of our relationship with and our membership in the community of beings, all beings, with trees and rocks and ravens and bears. I'd never heard poetry like that. I must add that at that time there was no way I could then imagine singing my own experience in my own voice as an 18-year-old young woman. Gary Snyder was no help there. In his travels, he stopped at many of the major Asian art collections around the country as he was lecturing and giving readings, which included the Cleveland Art Gallery, where he saw the Sung Dynasty Streams and Mountains Without End that he first heard of in the art book. And at the Freer Gallery in Washington, D.C., he saw what was probably the scroll... Oh, sorry. This is a little confusing. What was probably the scroll with the title that first caught his eye. But it wasn't until the late 1970s that the first translations of Dogen started to be available. And Snyder read Carl Bielefeld's translation. That was one of the earliest. Snyder has said in an interview, "Dogen's Mountains and Water Sutras slowed me down 10 years on this project because I had to think about it. It was such a wonderful exercise to try and absorb that and try to take it back to my meditation and my scholarship and play with it some more." Can you imagine? Oh! He also says that in the making of Mountains and Rivers Without End, Snyder's poem, at the conclusion of the book, he writes a little essay about it, about the making of, that Dogen spurred him to reconsider water more deeply. You know, he was a mountains guy. He had to look at the water side a little more. And that comes out here over time, is the water, what that means. Because the water side is the softer, flowing, compassionate side. He'd had plenty experience with the challenge, you know, scaling mountains. Maybe it was time to become a little more intimate with the water side. In the essay, his essay, he writes about that mountains and waters dyad, he calls it. He says, mountains have the mythic associations of verticality, spirit, height, transcendence, hardness, resistance, and masculinity. For the Chinese, they are exemplars of the yang, dry, hard, male, bright. Waters are feminine, wet, soft, dark, yin, with associations of fluid but strong, seeking and carving the lowest, soulful, life-giving, shape-shifting. And of course, we all have these qualities within us. Folk Buddhist iconography personifies mountains and waters with the images of Hudo Myo. This is Hudo Myo. He's typically depicted with one eye squinted closed and one fang going up and one fang going down. He's really fierce looking. And he comes from the Vajrayana tradition. People think of Zen as, Japanese Buddhism as Zen, but there's actually an even earlier Vajrayana tradition, Shingon and then Tendai, which is a mixed tradition, which is where Dogen started. Dogen started as a young man in Tendai, which had Vajrayana elements. Hudo means unmoving, and Myo-o is a wondrous king, and he's a guardian figure. He's usually pictured with a ring of flames around him, holding a sword to cut through delusion and a rope to teach us restraint. This is a very simple, kind of crudely carved one, in the style of Enku. Enku, I'm going to guess he was an itinerant monk and carver who traveled all over Japan, and he carved just thousands and thousands of these images, thousands of Kanon images, and they're all very crude. They look sort of like chainsaw sculpture, but he just gave them away and just left them all over Japan, and they're still really treasured because he was this kind of wonderful off the edges character. And I'm going to guess early 1700s, but I'll have to check myself on that. So this is an Enku sculpture of Hudo. Unmoving. Doesn't mean rigidly so. It means poised, ready to move in an instant in any direction. Real estate, this is called Fudo. Fudo-san. Unmoving goods in Japanese. Which is pretty funny considering, you know, how much real estate moves around these days. And he's often found you see him all over in Japan. And you often find him in waterfalls, kind of grottos, in a little, on a cliff edge, in a little alcove. So he's right beside this flowing water, right? It's on a rock. The rock creates the waterfall flowing. So they're just wonderful to see. And it's also their place of ascetic practice called Mizugyo, water practice, whereby you stand under a waterfall in a loincloth, or women wear a white cotton kimono, and you chant the Heart Sutra really, really hard, and you generate heat and spiritual power and chanting really hard under the waterfall. Michael got to do that once on a field trip. We could do it up there. That little waterfall. Some of them are just like that, just small. Just teasing.
Tomorrow morning.
So then, there's Kenman, who's sitting on our main altar, or Kuan Yin. She who hears the cries of the world, she who watches the waves of human life, are some of her names. And Snyder says, the two are seen as Buddha work partners, ascetic discipline and relentless spirituality balanced by compassion and forgiveness. Mountains and waters are a dyad that together make wholeness possible. Wisdom and compassion, the two components of realization. So you could see this whole long poem sequence as a kind, as his expression of the integration of those elements in his life and practice. Through a life of travel and deep exploration of myth, landscape, art, ethics, and spiritual practice, all those elements. So let's go back to the opening of the poem. I'm going to read you the opening poem and comment as I go. I'm sure I'll take too long. Clearing the mind and sliding into that created space. So he's inviting us to just clear our minds and enter into the scroll, the space of the scroll, the poem, to set out on a journey, embark on a voyage, kind of pilgrimage through life, right? A web of water streaming over rocks, air misty but not raining, seeing this land from a boat on a lake or a broad, slow river coasting by. So that image of our lives as riding in a boat, moving through an ever-changing landscape, is a common one, not just in Oriental poetry. Dogen uses it, Michael mentioned it yesterday in the Genjo Koan. He uses it kind of to illustrate how our self-focused view deludes us into thinking we are the fixed entities, you know, moving through everything else, and that we forget that we are in constant flux as well. Poem goes on. The path comes down along a lowland stream, slips behind boulders and leafy hardwoods, reappears in a pine grove. No farms around, just tidy cottages and shelters, gateways, rest stops, roofed but unwalled workspace. A warm, damp climate. A trail of climbing stair steps forks upstream. Big ranges lurk behind these rugged little outcrops, these spits of low ground, rocky uplifts, layered pinnacles aslant, flurries of brushy cliffs receding. Far back and high above, vague peaks. A man hunched over sitting on a log. Another stands above him, lifts a staff. A third, with a roll of mats or a lute, looks on. A bit offshore, two people in a boat. So now we imagine ourselves as travelers on foot, walking through the landscape of the scroll. Looking out at the mountain peaks in the distance and encountering other humans on our way. This is a landscape that includes the wild, untamed mountains and the mundane details of everyday human life. The word for landscape in Chinese is sanshui, or sansui, as Michael mentioned, mountains and waters is also the word for landscape. But the meaning of landscape is different from what we're familiar with in Western culture. I'm going to read you a little bit from David Hinton, who translated a lot of those old Chinese Taoist and Zen poets that we read last year. And he says, fundamentally different from writing that employs the natural world as a stage or materials for human concerns, this poetry articulates a profound and spiritual sense of belonging to a wilderness of truly awesome dimensions. This is not wilderness in the superficial sense of nature or landscape or TV documentaries, I should say. The terms that the Western cultural lens has generally applied to this most fundamental aspect of Chinese poetry. Nature, the word nature, calls up a false dichotomy between the human and nature. And landscape, to us, suggests a picturesque realm seen from a spectator's distance, right? In the West. But the Chinese wilderness is nothing less than a dynamic cosmology in which humans participate in the most fundamental way. The poetry of this wilderness cosmology feels utterly contemporary, and in an age of global ecological disruption and mass extinction, this engagement with wilderness makes it more urgently and universally important by the day. I think we could say the same of Dogen and Gary Snyder. So continue to travel along with the poem in this spirit, if you will. The trail goes far inland, somewhere back around a bay, lost in distant foothill slopes and back again, at a village on the beach and someone's fishing. Rider and walker cross a bridge above a frothy braided torrent that descends from a flurry of roofs like flowers. Temples tucked between cliffs, a side trail goes there. A jumble of cliffs above, ridge tops edged with bushes, valley fog below a hazy canyon. A man with a shoulder load leans into the grade. Another horse and a hiker. The trail goes up along cascading stream bed, no bridge in sight. Comes back through chinquapin or liquid ambers. Those are trees. Another group of travelers. Trails end at the edge of an inlet, below a heavy set of dark rock cliffs. Two moored boats with basket roofing. A boatman in the bow looks lost in thought. Hills beyond rivers, willows in a swamp, a gentle valley reaching far inland. The watching boat has floated off the page. What a wonderful line, huh? You'll see this happening again and again throughout this long sequence. Something ending, something continuing on. Here the page ends, but the watching boat and our observing eye floats on right off the page to whatever comes next. But the poem goes on. It now includes translations of the colophons added to the actual scroll. So here's how he tells it. At the end of the painting, the scroll continues on with seals and poems. It tells a further tale. Wang Wenwei, he's quoting the colophon now, Wang Wenwei saw this at the mayor's house in Hotung Town, year 1205, wrote at the end of it. So here's another poem. The fashioner of things has no original intentions. Mountains and rivers are spirit condensed. Who has come up with these miraculous forests and springs? Pale ink on fine white silk. So that was Wang Wenwei's poem. Later that month, someone named Li Hui added, "Most people can get along with the noise of dogs and chickens. Everybody cheerful in these peaceful times. But I? Why are my tastes so odd? I love the company of streams and boulders." Then, Tian Shui, Tian Xie of Wenlo, no date, next wrote, "The water holds up the mountains. The mountains go down in the water." True, right? The water holds up the mountains go down in the water. In 1332, Qi Shun adds, This is truly a painting worth careful keeping, and it has poem colophons from the Sung and Qin dynasties. That it survived dangers of fire and war made it even rarer." And in the mid-17th century, Wang To had a look at it and added, "My brother's relative by marriage, Wen Sun, is learned and has good taste. He writes good prose and poetry. My brother brought over this painting to show me." The great Qing dynasty collector Ling Qingpiao owned it, but didn't write on it or cover it with seals. From him, it went to the imperial collection down to the earliest 20th century. Chang Da Qian sold it in 1949. Now it's at the Cleveland Art Museum, which sits on a rise that looks out toward the waters of Lake Erie. So that's all in part of Schneider's poem, right? Mm. So some of these additions are poems that amplify and respond to the scroll, and others are mundane. And by the last one, the scroll seems to have become a status object, an antique. And now it's sequestered in a museum, right? So it's this wonderful sense of change, right? Continuing. And next layer is this poem, amplifying and commenting not only on the scroll, but on Dogen's Mountains and Water Sutra, which is likewise a commentary and amplification of the old Chinese ancestors that Dogen quotes. And so we add another layer. In their footsteps on the path of Dharma, every time we walk out into that forest, and maybe we'll add some words or some images to the call and response. So the poem's still not done. Now it's Gary Snyder again. "Step back and gaze again at the land. It rises and subsides. Ravines and cliffs like waves of blowing leaves. Stamp the foot, walk with it, clap, turn. The creek comes in, ah! Strained through boulders, mountains walking on the water. Water ripples every hill. I walk out of the museum, low gray clouds over the lake, chill March breeze." There's great movement in that passage. The land rising and subsiding, ravines and cliffs like waves or blowing leaves, cliffs rushing down over boulders, creeks rushing down over boulders, mountains walking on water. That's the first allusion to Dogen, mountains walking on water. Ascending and descending. The traveler dances with it all. Stamp the foot, walk with it, clap, turn. This is the dance of, anybody guess? Anybody who knows Japanese culture? No theater. The no performance. Very stylized. So he's going to use this dance of the no. No is the Japanese theater with the masks. Very, very still and formal with drums and claps. Yeah. It's very intensely still and dynamic. And ascent and descent, comes up over and over. Over the years of hiking that we have done, I remember with particular tenderness often some of the descents. After the toil of the ascent, you know, you're sweating and puffing, and sometimes there are squalls of hail, or wind, or blazing heat, or thunderstorms. We run into thunderstorms. And then the breathtaking expanse of mountain views, or sometimes socked in cloud, right? On the descent, there are different gifts. Sometimes, once coming down from the ridge of Cathedral Lakes, came into this beautiful, just that big subalpine meadow, and there must have been 12 or 15 does and little fawns of all sizes. And first very alert to us, and then just allowing us to walk through their meadow. And then once coming down off a mountain in Japan, we heard the sound of one of those great big taiko drums, boom, boom, boom. Louder and louder the lower we got. Then we came out into a Shinto shrine with no one there, this big pavilion with the big drum, except a father and his little girl and little boy practicing on the drum. And it was just this moment, right? Moment. So going up to the sublime and down, right, to the gifts of right here, every day in the world. So here's how he finally concludes the first poem. Old ghost ranges, sunken rivers, come again, stand by the wall and tell their tale. Walk the path, sit the reins, grind the ink, wet the brushes, unroll the broad white space, lead out and tip the moist black line. Walking on walking, underfoot earth turns, streams and mountains never stay the same. So now he's saying, take up the brush, begin to tell the tale, grind your ink, dip the brush in, and he does. Walking on walking, underfoot earth turns. The earth turns beneath us, as we know, we think we're walking on solid earth, but it's not, right? It's turning. It's moving. Walking the mountains in the footsteps of our ancestors. Streams and mountains never stay the same. This is going to be the refrain, those lines throughout the book. And that was just the first poem. So obviously we're not going to cover the whole sequence. And as I was getting into this, I was thinking, oh my gosh, there's so much, so many jewels in here. I think maybe when we go back, I'll do a Wednesday evening series. A Dharma seminar series at the Zendo. This long poem sequence is both chronological and not. It's both autobiographical and much more. It's divided into four sections that cluster roughly around the decades it took Snyder to write it. So the 60s were the time of his Zen practice in Japan, of finding his poetic voice, of his youthful zeal. And the 70s were a time when he came back and settled back in, built a house in the Sierras in California, rooted, made a home place, made a family. And this time blending into the 80s, where he was becoming more, going out into the world, becoming more of a public figure, writing and teaching and speaking as a Buddhist, poet, environmentalist. And then in the 90s, he pulled back somewhat from those roles, retiring from his university teaching and doing the work of review and integration that often seems to become imperative once one reaches 65 or so. And this is when he wrote the poems like the opening one, and then the closing one. So poems that link and connect the whole thing he wrote in the 90s, integrating the strands. So it becomes a kind of sutra. The Sanskrit word that sutra comes from is siv, S-I-V, which means thread, what stitches things together, right? Sutra has the same etymology. So we can see mountains and rivers without end as a kind of sutra stitching these different poems together like beautiful beads. So there are travel poems, there are animal poems, jackrabbit, canyon wren, bear, monkey, that open us to our relatives. And there are dreamtime poems, myth world poems, poems of goddesses and mountain spirits. But the overarching vision is of this world as one vast, interconnected network of mountains and waters, which he thinks of as a watershed, one big, vast watershed. And surely Dogen contributed to this vision. But Gary Snyder could only have articulated it from his own direct experience in the 20th century, with all its questioning of aesthetics and ethics of our human relationship to the wild. The wild within us, the wild around us. And those questions are more explicitly addressed in his prose essays, but they're implicit in the poetry as well, and they extend far beyond the personal. So as I said, there are many delights to be found in this book, like agates on the beach or granite cracked open to see the crystalline structure within. And so you may find them yourself if you will. And we'll look more at how he closes the book on Sunday. But for now, I hope you'll take some inspiration and some encouragement from both Dogen and Gary Snyder, as you venture forth, ascending and descending on your path through life and Dharma practice and into the mountains and forests and along the rushing streams here these few days. So thank you all for your patience and your listening.
May your attention equally